Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here, and I'm wondering, how's your lawn doing these days? Does it need a little work? Mine actually does need a little work, so I'm going to find out what I need to do with our guest today. Doug Soldat, back with us, professor in the Department of Soil Science at UW-Madison, specializes in turf grass. He looks at urban soils, nutrient management, water resources, soil testing, and landscape irrigation, among other things. And as we talk with him, I hope you'll join in. What questions do you have about improving your lawn, perhaps? What do you want to know about maybe starting a new lawn or transitioning your lawn care routine to the fall? Love to hear from you. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Doug, good to have you back. Thanks for joining in.
Great to be, but we're getting started here. Look at that. Get all the tongue ties out. Good to be here, Larry.
We had a pretty humid summer, I think.
Yeah.
What effect has that had on our lawns?
We saw more lawn diseases than I can remember in quite some time. It was humid. It was hot. We didn't get much relief for most parts of the Wisconsin from the rain. And we saw all kinds of diseases that we normally don't even see at all. Or if we do see them, they're in smaller isolated areas.
Yeah. How destructive are those?
They're really not. I think that's the good news here is that we do see occasional diseases, but very rarely will these kill the crown of the plant, which is the growing point. You might have brown spots for a while, but as soon as the weather conditions return to normal, which we're seeing right now with a little bit drier, cooler nights, you get regrowth. And this is the perfect time for recovery from the damage that may have occurred from diseases.
Yeah. And you're really not going to be able to prevent them.
No. golf courses will do it. If there's it's an economic reason to prevent it. Golf courses, maybe some high-end sports fields will apply fungicides. But for lawns, we very, very rarely would recommend preventing the disease.
Yeah. Seeding. Can we do that now?
Yeah, we're right at the end of the seeding window. It's a great time for the show just to remind everybody we got a nice weekend. Maybe the next weekend will be nice. This is a perfect time to get it in. But if you wait too long, you run the risk of a hard frost coming and killing some of the seeds that you planted. So really this weekend, next weekend, we're kind of getting close to the end of that optimum timing.
When is it necessary to reseed?
One of the great things about the main grasses that we have in Wisconsin, Kentucky bluegrass and fine fescues, is that they can recover, they can regrow into spots where they've thinned out. And so it's necessary when the grass is not well suited to that site. So if you have a full sun grass like Kentucky bluegrass in a really shaded area, that's an opportunity to reseed to a fine fescue that's more tolerant of the shade. But if it's just regular wear and tear or like a disease that we just talked about that's created some damage, just proper lawn care, irrigation, fertilization can bring that density back up without the need for reseeding. So it's kind of a case-by-case basis.
And how do you prepare the lawn?
Yeah, so one of the biggest mistakes I see people make with seeding is that they'll just put the seed right on top of the soil with very little preparation. The number one reason for failure is poor seed-to-soil contact. So you do want to work up the soil, remove the dead vegetation, loosen it up to an inch or two, plant that seed, rake the seed in to bury it about a quarter inch or so, and then step it down really nice. And that seed-to-soil contact is going to give you the good conditions the grass needs for germination.
Any need for straw or something else?
Depends on the size. If it's like a dinner plate or less, you probably can get away with no straw. But anything bigger than that, some type of mulch, some type of protective cover to keep the soil from washing away would be beneficial. And you can buy these in the hardware store at a bag of grass mulch, or you can use straw from a bale.
Yeah, it can make some sense. Weed control. Let's talk about that for a minute. Should we use it in the fall? And if so, what should be applied?
Yeah, the best time to control weeds, if you had to do it one time per year for broadleaf weeds, for example, dandelions or ground ivy, is around the time of the first frost. But that's not what most people do. It. Most people are controlling those weeds in the spring when we're doing garden talk, because you're seeing them and you're thinking about them. But right now is when they're most susceptible to the herbicides. They'll translocate the herbicide to the roots, and every year in our research studies we get the most effective control when we apply and around the first frost. You know, some of the leaves are changing color. It's sort of in October is the timing on that.
Dick in Brooklyn has a question that relates to this. Let's go there. Hi, Dick.
Hi. I've got a question about Creeping Charlie in my lawns. I've got a fair amount of that in there. I've sprayed it here now this fall with a herbicide. It's got 2,4-D dicamba and trichloroethylamine, I think is what it, the third thing in it. It just doesn't seem to be dying off the way I would expect it. It says on the label that it should control ground ivy or Creeping Charlie, but you know what else can I do?
Well, how long ago did you apply it?
I've applied it between up to three weeks ago. I'm doing, you know, different areas at different times, so it's been a work in progress.
Mm-hmm. Mm, yeah, so it does sometimes with some of the active ingredients, it can take 2 to 3 weeks to start being effective. So it's definitely not an overnight thing. You said you applied it about 3 weeks ago. You're not seeing much, which is surprising because the third active ingredient that you mentioned, triclopyr, is the most effective conventional control for that. I would check the label, check the mixing instructions, make sure that everything was applied at the proper rate. So sometimes that can be an issue if there was a miscalculation or something and not enough product got through. On the flip side, if you put too much product, that can also create a lack of control. So those are the two things I can think of. The timing might have been a little early with 3 weeks ago, and so maybe you'll get some better efficacy if you try it again in a couple weeks.
Yeah, closer to frost, you're saying.
Closer to frost, and then give you another chance to double-check the instructions on the mixing.
Yeah. Dick, there you go. Thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Ed in Northern Illinois, we'll turn to you. Hi, Ed.
Well, thank you for taking the call. So I have established grass areas, lawn, gets decent light, mostly mixture of bluegrass and fescue, probably the tall fescue, hasn't been treated in a few years and has some significant damaged areas from crabgrass and weeds like black medic that have taken over, it seems like taken over areas. But I'm trying to think of the best way to go back and attack that and try and revitalize this back to a nice lawn.
Yeah. Can I ask you a question? Do you fertilize your lawn regularly? Annually?
I haven't.
You haven't?
I haven't been.
Yeah. Okay. So that's those two weeds that you mentioned, black medic, which is a legume. It fixes nitrogen from the air. And then crabgrass, which is also really nitrogen efficient. Both of those weeds are sort of indicators of nitrogen deficiency. And so you'll want to apply a pre-emergent herbicide for the crabgrass in the spring. There's conventional chemicals that do that, and then corn gluten meal is an alternative or organic option for that. And you do that around the time when the forsythia bushes are blooming. It's usually sort of around in April, probably maybe late March in Northern Illinois. And then fertilizing around Memorial Day and Labor Day, so you could put down a fertilizer application now. That's going to thicken up your lawn, and that's going to prevent those types of nitrogen-efficient weeds from coming in. So one of the things we talk about in intro turf management here at University of Wisconsin is the best herbicide is a dense lawn, a healthy lawn, and to do that, 1 to 2 applications of nitrogen fertilizer are often beneficial.
Ed, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. We used to say 3 times.
Yeah, 3 times. I mean, the minimum, if you know, 1 to 2 times is the minimum. 3 times we're getting into the high maintenance zone for healthy lawn. Sometimes you'll see 4 applications. But with tall fescue, the grass that he mentioned, it's a lower maintenance grass, and 2 applications, I think, will do the trick for most tall fescue lawns.
Let's take a call from Karen in La Crosse next. Hi, Karen.
Hi. I just have a option for the gentleman that just called in about the Creeping Charlie.
Yeah.
So my neighbors, they have a very nice, lush green lawn, but they had Creeping Charlie starting. And what they've been doing throughout the summer is they've just been taking a tarp, laying it down over the area where the Creeping Charlie is, and kind of taking the tarp down so it doesn't blow away. But they leave the tarp on for, I don't know, maybe 2 weeks, 2 to 3 weeks. And the grass turns brown underneath, but the Creeping Charlie dies out, and then the grass grows, comes back in when they take the tarp off. But the Creeping Charlie apparently is not coming back.
Yeah, so tarping is another option for that alternative control. And I think, you know, some people just don't tolerate the brown grass that leaves. So it's basically like shade, a combination of shade and high temperature kill, depending on, you know, how hot it is or what the sun exposure is on the tarp, but just sort of smothering it. The risk with that is you can actually kill your grass that way. So 2 weeks, that's obviously in your case that hasn't killed your neighbor's lawn, but because of the changing environmental conditions, sometimes you can get grass that would need to be reseeded. That the tarping is a great option for mulched areas where the Creeping Charlie is coming in and there's no other plants to contend with, but that's absolutely an alternative option for controlling weeds in certain situations.
Yeah. Karen, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in too. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. Got a question about your lawn? I hope you'll join in. I'm Larry Mueller with my guest, Doug Soldat, professor in the Department of Soil Science at UW-Madison, for Garden Talk on WPR News. We're taking a look at your lawn today on WPR News with our guest, Doug Soldat. A little bit later on in the show, we'll be turning our attention to urban forests. That's at the bottom of the last hour of the show, but right now it's your lawn. And questions, again, join in at 800-642-1234, email to talk@wpr.org. Marshall in Green Bay, what's on your mind?
Hey, yeah, my lawn's got this clumping fescue, I think it is. I think some people call it quack grass. I know that my research says there's only, you know, Roundup that can kill it. How would you guys attack that problem?
Yeah, that's a tough one. So the first thing you said was clumping fescue. So are these are in clumps in your lawn?
Yeah, and they're in clumps, and you know when there's a little bit of a drought, everything else turns yellow.
That stays green. Yeah.
Yes, and it looks like a weed. It acts like a weed. It's just not a weed.
Yep. Yeah, and that is tall fescue, and so it's not quack grass, which is, I think, good news. Quack grass has a little bit of different appearance and growth habit. It's more common a problem in the early spring. But yeah, tall fescue is a desirable turf grass. Like if your whole lawn was tall fescue, you wouldn't notice that. It would stay green. Actually, one of the earlier callers from Northern Illinois had that in the lawn. But what we're seeing is it gets in as a contaminant, or maybe through the wind is blowing seeds from another area, and it forms these clumps of thick grass in Kentucky bluegrass and fine fescue lawns. It really stands out as a weed. Unfortunately, I can confirm your research that there is no selective way to get rid of it. You could spray it with a non-selective herbicide like Roundup, and you're going to have a dead brown patch. What I do often recommend, especially when the contamination levels are low, is just dig them out, and they don't regrow when you dig them out. So go out there, you know, spend a couple hours with a spade, and you just pop these things out and maybe put some soil back in the hole, but that will prevent, it won't spread, it'll prevent it from coming back. So you can either use a chemical approach or a digging approach with that tall fescue.
And then just throw some seed down? Or?
Yeah, depending on how big the clump is, you can throw down some seed. If it's really small, you might be able to just put some topsoil in, and your Kentucky bluegrass will fill in that gap. But yeah, tall fescue is a really common problem, and I see it growing in Wisconsin.
Marshall, there you go. Good luck. And get the spade out and go to work. There you go. Jill in northern Wisconsin, your turn. Hi, Jill.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Appreciate
sure.
it. Say, I live in up in Drummond, Wisconsin, and I have a food plot that's an acre big in front of my home, and it leads right up to my front yard. And somehow I acquired, I don't have the scientific name on me as I'm traveling, but it's called Asian moss, if you've heard of it. I've tried 2,4-D and Roundup, and I added a moss killer. We thought we were on top of it. This fall, we planted the food plot, added a bunch of lime because we're 800 pounds low. So, I mean, eight ton low. But anyhow, I'm just wondering if there's something else that you would know of that's starting to, like I said, creep up into our lawn now, and it just forms a mat across the whole area and nothing else grows.
Ooh, yeah, I haven't heard of that one before. We do encounter silvery thread moss sometimes in golf course situations, and there are very few, but there are a couple of options for controlling it. Number one is iron. So there's a product out there that contains iron, HEDTA, and the mosses are susceptible to excessive amounts of iron, which other plants can sometimes tolerate. So like a direct application of iron HEDTA herbicide could be an effective control. We've also seen recommendations for like Dawn dish soap. So come up with a soapy solution and apply that to the moss, which can also send it backwards. And then for silvery thread moss, there is a product on the market called Quicksilver that is labeled and effective for that species. But again, I think you said it was Asian moss. I'm not familiar with that personally. And I would contact your county extension office and they can direct you to somebody at within UW to answer that more specifically.
Yeah, that's I haven't heard of that one either. There you go, Jill. You can give those suggestions a try and maybe get a hold of your county extension person, and they might be able to, maybe there's a different name for it that we haven't heard
yet. Yeah, exactly. Sometimes with the names, they can be a lot of different names for things. So there's probably somebody in UW Extension that can get you better resources than I just did, or better suggestions than I did.
And the county person would have had probably would have heard about it from somebody else too by this time.
Yeah.
Jill, there you go. Thank you for calling. Cal in Menominee, Michigan, we turn to you now. Hi, Cal.
Hi there. My question is, I had some logging done, and I have literally some forests of brig mites, which have taken over, and I spray them and knock them down. I think I use 41% like sulfate or whatever. It's like a Roundup chemical.
Okay.
And I'm just wondering, when is the best time to use it?
Did you say Phragmites?
Yeah, Phragmites.
Yeah. Oh, shoot. So yeah, Phragmites is an invasive grass, really common. And unfortunately, I don't have a lot of experience or done research on Phragmites, on timing and control. So I'm going to have to punt this one. And again, I think, you know, contact your local county extension agent, and they're going to direct you to someone who has resources. It's a really common problematic invasive grass, but because it's not in lawns, I haven't had experience with it. So
I know if you go to the Wisconsin DNR and it's about weeds, troublesome weeds or something like that, and there's a section on Phragmites,
mm-hmm.
and its control or lack thereof. I think there's some control of it, but you could find some more from the DNR website. Probably Michigan DNR's got the same thing on its website,
too. I would guess, yeah.
Yeah. Dawn in Waukesha, we'll turn to you now. Hi, Dawn.
Hi. This is kind of for the whole audience. I don't know if I'm the only one noticing it, but I started at a new building, big hospital built, and on my way into work after rain, we would have to scrub the worms off of our shoes. And I've been there 15 years. There is no longer any worms in this parking lot, and I'm putting it into all the pesticides they're using to, you know, spray on the trees and the plants to go from scraping them off our shoes to no worms. And I'm wondering if other people are noticing it. I'm not seeing worms in my yard. I'm supposed they're good for grass and everything else. So maybe sometime later you can do a show on where the worms are going, where have all the worms going.
Right, Dawn. Has that been an experience that you've had, Doug?
Yeah, that's interesting. I haven't experienced that that phenomenon. I think there's reasons that worms can come and go from a population. It is illegal to control worms. There are no pesticides that are labeled or approved for that. Most of the insecticides that are applied to turf grass, and again, insecticides are rarely required in most situations. They will not harm earthworms, and herbicides, which are commonly used in landscape areas, are not known to negatively affect earthworm populations. Again, I don't know the specifics of that situation, but I have a feeling that it may be related to some type of environmental conditions, an excessive drought, a change in the grass cover, the soil type. I'm not aware of a widespread decline in earthworm populations in the Midwest.
All right. Well, I'll check around and see what we can come up with there, Dawn. If there is something, we'll find out about it and get it on the show. There you go. Thank you. Gary in Madison, we'll go to you next. Hi, Gary.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. So in my yard, I have these patches, these areas where the grass has turned, like, brown, and the ground is extremely hard. And there's other areas that are around that are growing. And I can't figure out what that is.
So how big a patch are you talking about, or patches?
Oh, probably like maybe 3 feet by 2 or 4 feet, those kind of areas.
Yeah.
So, it's almost impossible for me to know exactly what the condition is, but the most common reason that fits that description is creeping bent grass. So it is a very shallow-rooted grass that grows in patches about 2 to 3 feet in diameter, and it can spread rapidly, and it survives in areas that are wet. And so if the soil is really hard, it suggests it's drying up, and then that grass will brown out and kind of almost completely go away. Bad news is it'll return when the soil moisture conditions get back to normal. So, and then it's also doesn't do great in hot weather. It's susceptible to diseases. So there's a lot of reasons that the bent grass turns brown, which is why we consider it a problematic weed in lawn situations. That's my guess is what you're seeing. The best thing to do right now is actually just dig up and renovate those areas and plant some Kentucky bluegrass and fine fescue seed in there, to get those patches, growing and get a head start on the bent grass before it comes back.
How deep do you have to go down?
You don't have to go too deep. Again, it's very shallow rooted. It kind of, you know, this is one thing you can check for to see if it matches my description, is it should just kind of pull up like carpet. Very shallow rooted. So you want to, you know, just remove maybe the top couple inches, loosen the soil and plant your new seed in those patches.
All right, Gary, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. You can join in too, by the way. The number to call, 800-642-1234. Got a lawn question? Love to hear from you. 1-800-642-1234 or email to talk@wpr.org. Let's turn to Andy in Fort Atkinson. Andy, what's on your mind?
Well, I've got a lawn that we have a number of patches of clover that I'd like to try to get rid of. I don't really want to use the pesticide because we have our dog run back there. I'm concerned about that. I've tried adding additional nitrogen, but that doesn't seem to be doing anything yet. I've heard that low nitrogen is a sign of low nitrogen. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you bet. And you're exactly right. Clover is a legume. It takes nitrogen from the air and converts it into a form that that plant can use. And so it's competitive in environments where nitrogen is limiting. And in lawns, because we're mowing them all the time, they have all this vegetative growth. They have a relatively high demand for nitrogen. And so that would be the solution to keep the clover from coming back once you get rid of it. And the best alternative options for controlling clover will be an herbicide that I've mentioned already on the show earlier. It's iron HEDTA is the active ingredient. The first product that's kind of most well known is called Fiesta, but there's all kinds of different brand names that go along with it. But it's iron HEDTA. You can buy it in a squirt bottle and squirt it directly on the clover. The clover will sort of die or be harmed by the iron toxicity, which won't hurt your grass underneath, and you can get some advantage over those patches. Then fertilizing 2 to 3 times a year will keep that lawn thick and it'll prevent the clover from coming back into large patches.
Probably should talk about mowing height while we're at it. I think discuss it every single time, but it's always worth repeating.
Yeah, absolutely. Mowing height is another tool you can use to keep weeds from coming in. We have these long-term research plots at the OJ Noah Research Station where we're mowing either at 1.5 inches, 2.5 inches, or 3.5 inches. And there are so many more weeds in the 1.5-inch mowing height than in the 3.5-inch mowing height. So the taller grass, it'll have deeper roots, it'll prevent seeds from going down into the canopy and establishing. The grass is healthier, so the highest you can mow the grass is probably going to be the best at for the grass health and keeping weed competition low.
Andy, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. I've been using the last 2 summers. I bought an Ego battery operated lawnmower, and I like it a lot, and it does have some pretty fine adjustments that are simple adjustments to the height.
Right.
The old lawnmowers, some of them were difficult to get the proper adjustment. You might get it on one end, but it's high on one end and low on the other end or something.
Yeah. So the Ego's got like just a lever or something,
uh-huh.
Right? That's pretty fancy.
Yeah, it's I love that. And, of course, then you've got the battery, so I've got mm-hmm. a blower and a trimmer and everything else that can use the same batteries.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. They're lighter weight, pretty easy to maneuver. Yeah,
I absolutely love it. Well, Jerry and Ryle has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Jerry.
Hello, how are you doing?
Good, appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Well, we have a prairie flower bed that's part of an extension of our lawn, and it's been established for 3-4 years, but we have a lot of sandburrs in there, and I would like to get rid of the sandburrs, but I don't want to kill the native grasses or the prairie flowers.
Yeah, that's no fun if you're running around out there without shoes on.
Yeah, the sandburrs are in the prairie plot, but... Or are they growing in the lawn?
Well, the lawn is an extension to the prairie plot.
Okay.
So it's right next to the prairie plot.
Yeah, they're kind of joined together.
Yeah. Hmm.
Gosh, that's one that I haven't come across a lot. I know it is a annual, and so... You may be able to use a pre-emergent herbicide to prevent the seeds that hit the ground from establishing, and because it's an annual, it's going to be killed out over the winter. So I would check into to that. So the caveat to that is I don't know how many of your prairie plants are annual, and of course that if you put a pre-emergent herbicide down, you're going to prevent all the annuals from establishing, which you may not want. But in a lawn situation, you can put the pre-emergent herbicide down, which is the same thing that we recommend for crabgrass control, and that will prevent the sandburrs from establishing in the lawn area.
Yeah, and that's probably what Jerry wants. Although, could they be blowing in? I guess they can blow around a little bit. But if you want to keep them out of the lawn, the pre-emergent is the way to go.
Yeah.
Pretty much. Okay, Jerry, there you go. And that's in, usually Jerry's in Rio, so probably end of March, really.
Yeah, April will probably be good, yeah.
Jay in Two Rivers, we'll go to you. Thank you for calling.
Hello, gentlemen. Was last winter particularly hard on lawns along the lakeshore? Like Larry, we also have an Eagle lawnmower. In fact, it's got headlights because I often mow quite late in the afternoon and sometimes needs the light. I understand that's easier on the grass. We let the grass grow to over 4 inches, and I use the 4-inch setting. We use tall fescue seed, fertilize a couple times a year, and still this spring about a third of our lawn was dead. I went through 25 pounds of grass seed to bring it back.
Yeah, you're absolutely right that it was a very tough year. We had a lack of snow cover for big chunks of the year and very low temperatures. And so this year we saw probably more winter kill than I've seen in at least 10 or even more years. And specifically in lawns, I saw a lot of dead grass underneath trees. So I think there was a component of water stress and that desiccation, that cold winter air blowing over the grass and the underneath the trees, the soil tends to be drier because of the water uptake from the trees. I'm not surprised to hear that. And I do think it was sort of just a one-off, you know, something that we see maybe only every 10 to 15 years.
So you fixed it, Jay. That's the good thing. And hopefully it'll be another 10 or 15 years before it happens again.
Yeah, one more comment on that. You mentioned tall fescue, and tall fescue doesn't do great under intense winter conditions. It'll get, if you cover it with snow, it gets a lot of snow mold and the grass blades turn yellow. If you leave it open, you know, if it's exposed and they're cold temperatures, it can die from low temperature kill. And if you have ice, it absolutely dies, ice accumulation. So tall fescue is great for deep roots, high temperatures. It does a lot of really tough, it's really tough in the summer, but it can be a bit of a wimp in our winters.
No. Jay, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And you can join in too. Frank in Waukesha emailed us, how do you reseed bald spots in your lawn? We talked a little about that, but worth repeating.
I'll tell you how I do it. So I have a shovel. I got a dead spot size of a dinner plate or more, and I dig it up and I turn it over and remove if there's a lot of vegetation there, or remove it. If there's a little bit, I just kind of mix it in. So loosen the soil 3-4 inches or so. Then I put down my grass seed mix, and then I rake it in, and then I step down on it, and then I'll put mulch to cover about half of the soil. This is probably one of the most common mistakes I see is when people do mulch, they cover it completely. You want to still see half of the soil surface when you mulch it. So don't mulch too heavily. And then I water it in, you know, morning, afternoon, after work, something like that, if we're in a dry spell. But that's about it. Of course, the bigger the area you got, the more work that is. But that's how I tackle it for the dead patches.
I had a guest on the show a while back talking about woolets.
Yeah.
And they're essentially little pellets of wool that they've made into a mulch. And they work really... I got a bag, tried it on a little spot, and it worked really well. Holds the moisture in.
Yeah.
Got some nutritional value to it.
Yeah.
did a really nice job.
Yeah, actually. Absolutely. We worked with Woollett's with a greenhouse project, and great sustainable solution. Acts as a mulch, holds water, has some nutrients. And it's a local
made
Wisconsin
right
company.
Here in Wisconsin.
That's right. Yeah.
So that great. That was on September 13th of last year. As a matter of fact, I think Jill or Jeff's letting me know. And it's available, that show is available at our site for, if you go back to 2024, September 13th, you'll find it. So it's almost exactly a year ago. Tim in Juneau County, what's on your mind?
Hey, good morning. Question, we have very sandy soil, and it's been tough to get grass going. What's a good grass seed mix without bringing in a lot of topsoil?
Yeah, sandy soils are tough for sure. The two best options for that situation are fine fescues, chewings fescue and hard fescue. Chewings fescue does a little bit better with shady conditions. Hard fescue does a little bit better in full sun. You can go online and find places that will sell you just pure chewings fescue or pure hard fescue. So you can do that, buy them, combine them together. Or you can look in local garden centers for grass mixtures that contain some chewings and hard fescue. You'll often see other things like a bit of perennial ryegrass or some red fescue, maybe some Kentucky bluegrass. But you want the dominant grass species to be chewings and hard fescue for those really sandy soils.
And, you know, to replace that soil, I mean, it's not
worth it. I think the expense and the effort and it still may not work like you want it. I think the best thing to do is find the plants that fit that environment. And those fescue plants are perfect for very dry, nutrient poor soils.
All right, Tim, there you go. Thank you very much for calling. Alex from Fitchburg emailed, his lawn is somewhat uneven and rough. I'll raise my hand in support of that because that's what my lawn's like right now, it seems. He'd like to level and make it smoother. He's seen people on YouTube add sand and use a wide-spreading tool to level it, but he also has read that adding sand can the soil can turn into a form of concrete. What do you recommend?
Yeah, that's a good. I'm glad he brought that up because I wouldn't recommend top dressing with sand for most lawn situations, especially for leveling. We say kind of clay and sand is part of the recipe for concrete, which is true. Now, golf courses will do this. They'll take their whatever soil is and they'll add sand consistently for a number of years, and they end up building a sand cap on top of the native soil, and that is beneficial for a number of reasons. But for this caller, you can do basically the same thing that you see on YouTube, and you can find other YouTube videos that do it with a nice silt loam topsoil, which is likely to match the soil that you have. So it involves shaving your lawn down nice and low, bringing in a load of topsoil, and then kind of slinging it around, and then using this wide leveling tool that was described to kind of bring the soil into the low spots and pull it off of the high spots. And so, again, do that with topsoil, and you should have just as good of results if you do it with sand. Or better.
Why does that happen? Now, I had my lawn was pretty good, and you know, I was mowing it last week, and I thought, man, where did all these kind of bumpy and holes and
yeah, you know, that's a fun. I was up at the crop and soils field day at Arlington this summer, and I was talking to with a gentleman there to learn about the UW research, and I told him what I did, and he said, man, I have the bumpiest lawn this year. And he said, it's never been like this before. And I think when we were talking about the winter earlier, the frost depth got a lot deeper than it got in previous years. And I think we saw more frost action than we have in a while. And so that's what I'm going to attribute it to. But yeah, it's tough. It'll naturally settle. It takes time, but right now there's a lot of bumpy lawns out there. You can roll them. It's not our favorite practice to recommend. You have to wait till the soil's wet enough to be compacted, but you're essentially compacting the soil. But you will smooth it out a bit if you do that. If you do that as well, just remember to loosen it up occasionally. So maybe aerify the following fall if you do it next spring. But rolling the lawn with a water-filled roller can smooth out some of those bumps.
Doug Soldat, our guest today, as we talk lawns with him. Doug, of course, a professor in the Department of Soil Science at UW-Madison. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk and WPR News. Great to have you along for this edition of Garden Talk. As we look at your lawn today with Doug Soldat from the UW-Madison Department of Soil Science, join in, numbers 800-642-1234, email to talk at WPR.org. Let's go to Sue in Oshkosh next. Hi, Sue.
Hi. Well, I love your show. I listen to it as often as I can, and I might have even heard this from a previous show. When I had a couple of small bare spots in the lawn, I put used coffee grounds. We drink a lot of coffee, and I've had, you know, a pot of coffee every day. I let the ground sit for a little while, and I just sprinkle them on the bare spots. I was a non-believer, and it has really taken off. Even some larger spots that can be about 2 feet by a foot-ish, you know, round, and the grass actually grows in and around there, and I have very few bare spots anymore.
Sue, good for you. Comment, Doug?
Yeah, coffee grounds. I mean, it's a plant. It's got all the plant nutrients in it, the coffee beans. So not surprised at all that the grass is responding positively to it. We often talk about compost as a really nice, coffee grounds as a really nice addition to compost, which you can also do. You can put all of your food scraps together, compost those, and then you'll have a very rich soil-like material that will greatly enhance the health of the lawn. So glad to hear you're having success with just the raw grounds, and not surprised to hear that. So
yeah.
Good work.
Thank you very much for calling. Something to think about, that's for sure. Eric in Sturgeon Bay, on to you now. Hi, Eric.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my call. The reason that I'm calling is that I live on the water in Sturgeon Bay, and so I've learned to use corn gluten as my weed killer. And, of course, it's pre-emergent, so it goes on early in the spring. But I'm wondering how effective it is this time of year, and if it's not very effective, is there something else I can use in its place?
Yeah, so corn gluten meal is a dual-purpose product. One of the reasons we really like it is it will prevent weed seeds from germinating, and then it also has a 10% nitrogen in it and no phosphorus, so keep the phosphorus out of the lakes, out of the bay, and but the nitrogen is soaked up quickly by the lawns and gives the lawn density to prevent other weeds from coming in. So if you apply it now, it'll work as a good organic fertilizer. It'll help thicken up your lawn. It'll prevent weeds, but there's not that many weed seeds germinating right now, so that's why we don't recommend fall applications routinely. But like I said, it's a fertilizer product, and you can use it for that purpose in the fall. Best time to use it is next spring, before the crabgrass starts to germinate to prevent that from coming back.
Yeah. All right. Eric, go. Well, there you go. Thank you for calling. And Peter in Milwaukee, it's your turn. Hi, Peter.
Hi. I've been seeing on television they have this light green slurry spray that you can coat the lawn, coat a bare spot on the lawn, and it has all the ingredients. Have you heard of this?
Yeah. So hydromulch it's been around quite a long time, and essentially it's a liquid mulch mixed in with seed and the fertilizer. And so it's often used by professionals and landscaping companies, golf courses for like really large products because you just spray it out of a hose. It's kind of cool to see. It's like you're painting the landscape. So, yep, absolutely a technology that's out there and quite effective for reseeding large areas.
It pricey?
Well, there's an infrastructure cost. You have to have the tank and you have to have the right equipment to apply it. So it's really not possible unless you're doing it professionally.
Yeah, that makes sense. Or you can, I don't know if they rent those at the one-day rental places or not.
Gosh, I don't know. That's a good question. I haven't seen it, but I think more likely you might just hire, if you have a large area, you'd hire somebody that to seed your lawn that might be using a hydro mulch.
Yeah, system. That makes sense. Peter, there you go. Thank you. Susan in Madison, your turn. Hi, Susan.
Thank you for taking my call. I have a problem in my lawn of moss. I have a lot of moss growing. I have treated it with Moss X in the patches where it's just solid moss. But then I'm pulling out Creeping Charlie in other areas of my lawn, and there is moss growing under there. Mm-hmm. What is the best way to treat the moss? And then is it good to fertilize before treatment or after treatment? Thank you for your answer.
Yeah,
well, one question would be,
how shady is this site?
I was going to say, cut down all your trees and you won't have any moss. Yeah. Oh, boy.
If you're still on, is it a very shady area?
The area that was quite shady has responded to the Moss X treatment. But then, you know, during the day, it gets shady, but it also gets a lot of sun in the afternoon.
Yeah. Okay, so silvery thread moss, which is, it's a really cool plant. This is the same moss that you can see growing on rooftops. So everybody thinks, oh, it needs the shade. It doesn't need the shade. It grows in places where other things won't. And so usually when we see moss in any turf grass area, we think, okay, what's preventing the grass from growing? A lot of times it's shade. But in a full sun area, you should be able to have success by reseeding with a fine fescue mixture that's better adapted to those tougher conditions. So in a shady spot, I would say you're probably going to continually be battling this because most grasses just can't tolerate the shade that moss and plants like ground ivy can tolerate. But if you do have enough sun, renovate that area, dig it up, plant a fine fescue mixture, and the grass should outcompete the moss. You only see moss where grass can't grow or isn't growing.
All right. Susan, good luck, and thank you. And Bob in Solon Springs, your turn. Hi, Bob.
Hi there. My question is about mulching lawnmowers. I live here in Solon Springs. We've got a ton of deciduous trees, a ton of leaves coming down all the time, plus the mowing of the lawns. And I've been told by some people, oh, yeah, don't worry about bagging the clippings. Just let it all go right back into the lawn. It's all good for the soil, and it's good for the grass. But I've had better success when I go out there and try to rake all of the dead stuff out from between the plants. And I'm curious what your thoughts are about these mulching lawnmowers versus bagging the clippings.
Oh, yeah. Great question. So we do some research on this at the University of Wisconsin where we removed the leaves. We let them sit there and then we mulched them back into the canopy. I think we did that over a 3-year period, and the best results that we got in the full sun, regular conditions, was when we mulched them into the canopy. We find more soil moisture is retained, fewer weeds come in. So in general, our recommendation is that mulching deciduous leaves is the best. Now, I can say that there's likely exceptions to that if you have too many tree leaves where mulching still creates a lot of shade, or it could be a situation where, removing some of that's going to be beneficial. In general, mulch and those tree leaves create a lot of shade. So just getting them off is probably the best step. But if you can mulch them in and it's not covering up all the grass, that's probably going to be your best step. But I can't think of too many drawbacks to mulching leaves unless there's too many of them.
I put it right back into the... Saves a lot of raking, too. If you do it that way.
Yeah,
saves a lot of raking.
Yeah.
Doug Soldat will be with us for another half hour on the show to take your lawn care questions. Looking forward to that. Stay with us. We'll take a quick look at the news, find out what else is in store for us, and then we'll be back with Doug. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk. You are listening to Garden Talk here on WPR News. Larry Mueller here with my guest Doug Soldat, professor in the Department of Soil Science at UW-Madison. He knows a whole lot about turf grass and soil and nutrient management, water resources, soil testing. We haven't even mentioned that. But you can join in with your questions, and I hope you do as we move along the program. He will be with us for about another half hour or so. And Vicki in Mequon has a question, so let's go there. Hi, Vicki.
Hi there. Yes, we live on 1 acre in a subdivision. My yard has full sun. We do have a weed and feed program. But last year on the south side of our house, we had an area, 30 by 40, that had lots of splotches of dead grass. And, you could just scrape the grass away. We ended up in the fall, taking all the grass those spots off. They were about anywhere from 1 feet by 1 feet to by 3 by 4. And we could put down soil and seed and fertilizer. Grass did come back. But this year, we're having the same problem in the same area and also in our front yard. So I was wondering, when the gentleman came to fertilize last week, he said it's definitely not grubs. And he checked for that all over the lawn. And he assumed that it was a fungus. So I was wondering, what should we do? Can you apply a fungicide? Do we just keep patching the lawn?
Yeah.
Yeah, good. So, my first thought as you're describing was it sounds like it could be grubs. And so I'm glad to hear that that it was scouted, determined that that wasn't the issue. We started off the show talking about how hot and humid things were, and that's the conditions that are ideal for disease. And so the next step would be to get a diagnosis to see if it is a fungus that is attacking the area. Based on everything you said, I have no reason to think it's anything, it's hard to tell, but a fungus, I can't rule it out. We have a turf grass diagnostic laboratory here in Madison. So it's tdl.wisc.edu, and they accept homeowner samples. And on that website, they have instructions for how to make a submission. It involves taking a sample, taking pictures, filling out some basic information. But that's a really good resource to have, so we can correctly identify the problem and then get some solutions. And if it's not a disease, they'll also give you some recommendations on what it might be and how to tackle it.
So it's tdl.wisc.edu.
Correct, yep. Turfgrass Diagnostic Lab.
All right. Vicki, and so just get a show you. Well, the instructions are on the site.
Yeah,
so
it'll walk you through it. And I guess to the caller's question, should I apply a fungicide? It's unlikely that that's what's going to be. A lot of times, the fungicides, by the time you see the damage, it's too late. They've already attacked the roots, which is causing the brown patches do occur, and now you focus on recovery. Things you can do to focus on recovery: you can reseed the area, you can apply a fertilizer right about now to encourage growth, assuming the fungus is gone. The weather conditions have turned a bit recently, and then you can keep the area moist to encourage new plant growth as well.
Vicki, there you go. Thank you for calling. Let's turn to Ann in Eau Claire. Hi, Ann.
Hi. My parents have a huge lawn, and they've always had, gophers, one or two gopher mounds every once in a while. this year it's outrageous. I bet you there are 30 gopher mounds in their yard, and I need to know how to get rid of them because they're tunneling and raising the grass, and it's all bumpy, and it's crazy. I mean, I mow, and I get to the other side of the yard, and they've already made more gopher holes.
Oh my gosh!
But they're tunnels that you can see, right?
Yeah, you can see where they've tunneled, and it's raised the grass and the dirt up, you know, half an inch to an inch.
Sounds more like moles to me than gophers, because gophers would be a gopher hole, but I don't think they tunnel with, so you have a raised stretch of grass, of dirt or soil and grass.
Are you seeing the animal?
I'm not seeing the animal, but when you mow, you're hitting that mound of dirt that is like 2 to 3 inches tall.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it could be moles, it could be gophers. I think with both of those, the solutions are either trapping them or baiting them with some type of material. And probably the ideal solution will depend on if it is a gopher or a mole. And so, you know, that would be the first step, is try to get some visual confirmation of what it is. And then there are all kinds of great resources online about how to deal with gophers and moles. And what I would do is go to Google, and then this is one of my best search tips, is you type in the issue and then you do the word site, S-I-T-E, colon, dot, E-D-U. And it's going to give you just the resources that are coming from a university. You could even put WISC.edu. And that's going to give you the Wisconsin resources on mole control or gopher control or whatever that issue is. But I just, you know, I'm a lawn expert, and the animal part is a little bit outside of my comfort zone.
If I'm visualizing it right, it sure sounds like moles to me, as opposed to gophers.
Yeah.
Especially if you're never seeing them. They're underground all the time, and those traps look awful. But they can be pretty effective. And there are some worm-like things for moles that you actually cut up kind of a hole in the tunnel and drop one of them in. And so protecting against the family dog eating one.
Oh, right, right.
And they're found by the moles. And usually it doesn't take too many moles to make it look like there's 30 of them out there, and there might only be two or three.
Really ambitious ones, yeah.
Two really ambitious ones. And there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Mary in Madison, we'll go to you. Hi, Mary.
Hello. I am calling about my backyard. I live in Madison, and over the years, the trees have really filled in, and our grass has been less and less and less, and it's gotten so bad it's just weeds and bald spots. So I'm wondering, I did request a soil kit. I'm sure it won't tell me much because I'm sure it's that it's shaded, but looking for maybe some solutions on some good ground cover options.
Yeah, great question. So that's one of the things that we'll often recommend is, you know, grasses just don't do great in the shade. And so consider other ground cover options that are shade tolerant, or make, you know, the flower beds really large underneath the surrounding the base of the tree, and you can kind of design really cool landscape elements that way. If you do want to go the grass route, there is one species that is this a dry area, or would you say it's usually wet?
It gets a little wet, I think. But I don't know, not all the rain gets through all the leaves. So
yeah, so it's not like you can't walk out there after it's rainy.
Right.
The best grass, if you want to try to get some grass going in there, is Chewings fescue. That one is best adapted to shade. It survives underneath most trees, and it's likely that you didn't have very much of that before. So if you do want to give the grass another shot, go with Chewings fescue. Otherwise, I would be just looking at, you know, larger, expanding the landscape beds under there, planting shade-tolerant plants. You know, there's no, like, perfect ground cover that's going to work and give you what the lawn was giving you, but there's a bunch of options out there that you can consider.
Mary, there you go. Thank you very much for calling. And Porter in Sun Prairie, it's your turn. Hi, Porter.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. Appreciate the call. What can we do for you?
Thank you. So I'm going to be having a wedding in the spring coming up here in 2026 in May, roughly middle of May. And my dad has a hayfield that he grows and cuts to feed a few steer. And we rented a 60 by 100 sailcloth tent that we are going to put on the most level spot we could find, which so happens to be in this hayfield. And my soon-to-be father-in-law and my father kind of have different ideas of how we should prep this hayfield or pasture to get it in an acceptable form where, you know, people can be walking on it, where it's not so thick base like hay usually is, but something, you know, more like a normal yard grass. Do you have any, like, procedure or recommendations as far as if we should mow it very often before winter in the fall here, or mow it more in the spring, or kind of what's your idea what we should do?
And when are you having the wedding?
It's going to be in May of next year.
May of next year, okay.
Yeah, so I would mow. So I would be mowing it. Is it mowed down yet?
Yeah, he just cut and baled this past weekend.
Yeah, so I would start taking kind of, you know, like a homeowner grade, you know, mower out there and just continually mowing it every week. And that's going to chop up some of the residue that's there. The wheels are going to provide a little bit of compaction on the area. And then when spring hits, I would just continue mowing it. And, you know, mowing will eliminate a lot of plants from coming in. It's going to keep things nice and short. And then the grasses that can tolerate the mowing are going to start to come in and predominate. So you said there was a difference. What were the two options that the father and father-in-law were considering?
My father-in-law was, or soon-to-be father-in-law, definitely had the very similar idea what you had. My father had more of an idea of leave it be for now and then, like, cut it a bunch, like a month or a couple weeks beforehand, and it should be fine.
All right, I'm gonna side with the future father-in-law here and say take the most aggressive approach and just mow that as frequently as you can, and that's going to give you the best result.
Yeah. Mow the path out to it, too.
Yeah.
There you go, Porter. I think you can, and now you have an expert on grasses giving the advice, and so that should assuage some of the potential hard feelings. There you go. Tony in Appleton, we'll go to you next. Hi, Tony.
Hi, how are you?
Good, appreciate the call.
Good. So a couple of months ago, I had a new patio put in the backyard consisting of pavers, you know, the paver blocks.
Yep.
So the contractor came in, dug out all of it, and then came back in with that fine little gravel type of stuff. Yep. And then started laying the pavers. But what we also had him do was we had some low spots in the yard. So he brought in some topsoil and then seeded it with a blend of grass seed. And the only one I can remember is bluegrass, I think it is. And the grass is growing pretty well. I mowed it last night, and I'm just kind of wondering, going into the winter here, fall and winter, do I need to, since I mowed it, do I need to put more seed down, or do I need to continue watering it or increasing my frequency? I'm just kind of unsure.
Yeah, sounds like everything is going pretty well. Keep mowing it. Mowing's really important. You know, if we have this thing called the one-third rule. You don't want to mow more than one-third of the grass off at any one time, so you kind of judge your mowing by that. Do you need to water it? Yeah, for new established stands like that, if it starts to wilt or if it looks like it's not growing because there's not enough water, I would recommend putting on water so it can continue its growth. An application of fertilizer probably wouldn't hurt around now to encourage that grass to fill in. But right now, you know, for the next, even into next year, it's going to continue to mature. And so mowing helps that. having adequate moisture will help that. Fertilizing around Labor Day, Memorial Day will help that grass fill in. But don't, you know, it doesn't sound like you need to add any seed. You just need to encourage the grass growth that, you're seeing.
There you go, Tony. Thank you so much. Some emails we should address here. Sergio in Princeton emailed to say he was wondering what area or what would be the best low or no-mow grass that he could plant in his area. He'd like to plant native plants with the low or no-mow grass as well. Any ideas?
Yeah, the best low no-mow grasses are in general the fine fescues. It includes a collection of very closely related species: sheep's fescue, chewing's fescue, hard fescue, strong creeping red fescue, slender fescue. So those fescues, not tall fescue. Tall fescue is sounds similar, but it's one that you want to avoid. So those fescues are what's used often in these low-mow, no-mow mixes. They do very good under drought conditions. They do good with low fertility. They do good with low mowing. So that's definitely the grass. And they do mix well with other natives or bulbs or things that you wanna plant with it. So go with one of those fine fescues for that ultra-low maintenance area.
Ed emailed to ask if there's a way to transition an old bluegrass and tall fescue healthy lawn to a fine fescue bluegrass lawn.
The obvious first option is that you can kill everything and till it up and start again. And my guess is that that's, you're looking for an alternative to that. And so with that, you could try to overseed the lawn. You can rent overseeders from rental places. You can cut your grass down really low, run the overseeder over it in kind of in two directions, forming like a diamond pattern. The overseeder puts grass down about inch apart in rows. And then make sure you keep it well watered and good moisture through the fall, and you'll hopefully see some of that fine fescue start to catch, and then you can try that again the following fall. And so that's more of a slow transition approach than just kind of killing everything and starting over with a fresh seed bed.
Sonia in La Crosse, the La Crosse area, emailed to ask, when is the best time to aerate her lawn? Many of the home stores in her area no longer rent aerators. Any suggestions on where she could rent one?
Yeah, I know you can contract out the service with local lawn care companies. Rent-a-centers, I'm not sure, but a little surprised that
there's
that
not an A to Z rental
yeah.
Place in the La Crosse area. I'd have thought there would be one.
Right. Yeah. I would check with a local lawn care contractor. The other question is, what's the timing? The timing is right now. Now is a great time to aerify because you pull up soil, you expose the soil, and with that would come the potential for weeds to germinate, but there aren't very many weeds that are germinating right now in the environment. So it's a good time to make that soil exposure. And then if you want to put down seeds that you do want to encourage, those will germinate with the soil that you bring to the surface. So a lot of times these will only make holes every 5 inches, and that's not very much. I would recommend 2-3 passes and really make a lot of holes on your lawn to have the best impact from an aerification event.
Amy emailed, they live in Wausau and are wondering what time in spring would be best to apply pre-emergent to the lawn, considering they are in zone 4.
Yeah, so great question. The pre-emergent herbicides are preventing a seed from germinating. So the best timing is just before that seed is going to germinate. And the seed that we're trying to prevent most often is crabgrass. And crabgrass germinates when soil temperatures are in the 60s. And so the best timing is when your soil temperature in the top inch or so is 50, 55 degrees. Most people aren't out there with their soil thermometers all the time. So we use indicators in the landscape. And one of the best ones is the forsythia bush, which is these bright yellow landscape bushes that bloom when the soil temperatures are around 50 to 55 degrees. So when forsythia are in full bloom, which could be any time from March to April, in maybe even May if it's a really cold spring, that's about the time when you want to think about getting your pre-emergent herbicide down.
Question relating, an email question relating to golf courses. What are golf courses doing to help with the environmental effects of fertilizers and monoculture?
Yeah, golf courses are really, I think, misunderstood for many people. You look at them and you see this, it almost looks artificial in some cases, how short the grass is, how green and how perfect it is. But golf course superintendents are some of the most highly trained and well-educated professionals in the turf grass industry. And they're leaders. They have a strict set of regulations from Wisconsin DNR. They go to educational trainings about nutrient loss and pesticide use. And so this is a group that really knows their stuff about water conservation. And that's one of my jobs at the university, is to do research that we can extend to those professionals so that they're maximizing their nutrient use efficiency, minimizing their use of pesticides, and still producing those conditions. And so certainly there are things that the industry can improve on as a whole. But, you know, rest assured that that's one thing that University of Wisconsin is doing great work on, is improving the environmental impact of golf course management.
But that brings to mind your lab, and you have mentioned research that you've done over time. What are you working on in the lab right now?
Yeah, one thing we're working on, which I'm super excited about, is a soil moisture sensor that you can attach to the back of a fairway mower. So as they're mowing the fairways, this sensor will be collecting accurate real-time data on where the soil moisture levels are, so that can communicate back to the irrigation system and put down just the right amount of water. So a golf course might have 1,000 irrigation heads, and so you can imagine that adjusting those individually is a big task. But if you have this a system that's automated to identify where the soil moisture is high and low, and then communicate back with the irrigation program, we're just super excited that can result in significant water savings.
So it's something going on in agriculture as well, the identifying areas in a field.
Yes.
So science has really come a long way on
precision
that.
Precision turf management. We had a demonstration of a drone. So dollar spot is a very economically damaging disease on golf courses, and it occurs not everywhere, but in little spots and patches. And the conventional way is, well, if you have a fairway that has some areas that are affected, the whole fairway gets treated. But now with these drones, you can just come on and just zap, just right on top of where the disease is, and it can save significant amounts of money and environmental impact,
man hours,
all kinds of benefits to precision turf management.
Doug, it's always a pleasure. Thanks so much for being with us today, and we'll look forward to your next visit. Appreciate it very much.
Thanks, Larry. Glad to be here.
Doug Soldat, professor in the Department of Soil Science at the UW-Madison, our guest. Always great to have him come by. Coming up, we're going to be talking about the uses for urban wood with our next guest, Dwayne Sperber. Excuse me. He's the owner of Woodward and founding partner in the Wisconsin Urban Wood Network. So stay with us for that. Some really cool stuff going on there. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Well, you probably don't think of your cities as forests, but lots of trees are planted and removed each year. I spent, about 6 or 8 years on the Dane County Tree Board, and I got schooled on what's going on in the way of trees in Dane County, for sure, and I know the same thing's happening all over the state. And we're going to hear today about some work being done to assure sustainability and regeneration of those trees with our guest, Dwayne Sperber. Dwayne is owner of Woodward and founding member and advisor of the Urban Wood Network, an allied member of AIA Wisconsin, the American
Institute
of Architects. I suddenly forgot that for a second. American Institute of Architects. He's also a member of the Wisconsin Arborist Association, Urban and Community Forest Society, and a former member of the Wisconsin Urban Forestry Council. A busy guy, to say the least. As we talk with him, I hope you'll join in. What questions do you have about using wood from urban areas? Would you like to know how you can have a tree on your property maybe used in this way? Join the conversation. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234 or email to talk@wpr.org. Welcome back, Dwayne. Good to have you with us again.
Thank you, Larry. It's very good to be here.
So, urban wood. Explain what we're talking about here.
Sure, Larry. Urban wood, let's give you the fancy definition, refers to wood from trees that were removed for reasons other than harvest. Urban and community trees, they live, they grow, they provide all kinds of benefits, and like all living things, they ultimately decline and must be removed. And way back in the early 2000s, at least here in Wisconsin, the Emerald Ash Borer reminded us of the value of our trees. We were losing thousands upon thousands of ash trees, and that started kind of an idea, kind of a movement, if you will. What can we do with all these trees? And this was happening during a time when sustainable design and construction were becoming buzzwords and a lot of interest there. And, you know, we kind of thought, well, why not utilize all these trees?
Sure.
So that was way back in 2003, and we have finally put feet under this new budding industry, the urban wood industry. And I like to always remind folks that the urban wood industry does not exist without the planting and care of our essential urban community trees. In other words, we don't go out and harvest trees, so to speak. We capture trees after they've been removed and introduce higher use disposal options for their use. And that pretty much sums up kind of what we do.
Yeah, well, what happens if they're not? I mean, where does it go?
Many times, now, trees are a tremendous liability to a community. They must be carefully and thoughtfully and safely removed. And that hazard, at times, must be managed very quickly. And many times, the go-to process would be to chip that tree. It's very manageable. They can get rid of it. Or sometimes, maybe it's landfilled. But we've grown a lot of interest and hopefully excitement that communities can divert in these waste streams, a waste stream, and get it to someone who can continue the life of that tree through urban wood products, which comes packed with all kinds of environmental benefits. In other words, in an ideal scenario, it would be better to keep that log as wood as otherwise. And the urban wood industry here and my company exists to make that process easy. So I work in every section of the industry, from working with the municipality to introduce these options. We also produce urban lumber, which goes into all kinds of applications, from manufacturing to some pretty significant projects here in Wisconsin.
Some really beautiful projects going on. I looked at your website, and Woodward, by the way, is spelled W-U-D-E-W-A-R-D.
Yeah.
If people want to go online to the site, W-U-D-E-W-A-R-D is the site.
Yeah, thank you.
So I think the one question that would come to mind is, well, I've got one tree in my backyard. How is that going to be economically feasible for you or somebody to come in and just a lot of person hours to
sure.
do it?
There's a lot of different ways. We're you noted that I'm a member of the Wisconsin Arborist Association, and I know a lot of arborist and tree care professionals, and I always say they're some of the best people that I know. People caring mm-hmm. for keeping our trees alive and healthy and safe. And we are encouraging them in introducing cost savings and efficiencies by keeping the log portion of the tree as long as possible at the time of removal. That ultimately can save them money. But in the meantime, the Urban Wood Network, which is a nonprofit association, which is now a national organization with strong roots here in Wisconsin, has members who would perhaps come and retrieve that tree off your property if they know this arborist and process that tree. Larry, you could have something made from that tree, from the lumber created from it, or you can have a big heart and say, I want this to go into this material stream, this urban wood material stream. And as Urban Wood Network member, that builds confidence in our buyers. Our homeowners know that the tree, if it was sustainability and they wanted to utilize a tree other than wasting it, if that's a part of their story and their desire, working with an Urban Wood Network member would be a great way to find those makers and those that would do that.
And how do we find those?
Yeah, urbanwoodnetwork.org, all one word, urbanwoodnetwork.org. And you can search by state. And here in Wisconsin, you can find a tree care professional, a maker, someone who could mill your wood, all kinds of resources on that website.
Projects that describe some of the projects that have.
Well, I'm very excited coming up. Actually Tuesday, some of you may be familiar with the newly expanded Baird Center in Milwaukee, the big convention center, and working with the architect and a grand urban wood collaborative stairwell was specified in Urban Ash. And what a beautiful public space to demonstrate our public trees in action, those that diverted, you know, the landfill and became products, creating jobs, creating social equity. People feel good about being around wood, period. And the fact that they can gather and use a functional stairwell, that, and function's a key word. It isn't always a romantic application. Oh, look at this beautiful wall hanging. This is lumber that can be utilized functionally and, let's say, in familiar ways as well. And it just comes packed with a good story, though.
So when a tree is cut down in an urban area, it's often, it may be diseased or it may be, you know, the core may not be in
might
very
be good. Hollow. Yeah.
Might be hollow.
That's the nature of the beast. That's what we get. And in our model, my business model, we accept anything from a municipality, for example, that they don't want to chip. So with that comes the good, the bad, and the ugly. And that service to the community helps them save money. It saves them time on a job removal. We get everything, the entire production of a tree. From that, we do almost nearly constant sorting into logs that are millable, into brush that can become animal bedding, for example, or some other product. And about 25 or 30% of what a municipality produces is millable into lumber. And so we will find a use for any quality of material that comes in. That's any sawmill. They're going to use every little bit of sawdust, you know, board and sawdust to make that effort. Well, I must use the word profitable. We do this because it's not only sustainable, but it must be profitable, economically viable.
Our guest today, Duane Sperber, owner of Woodward and founding member and advisor of the Urban Wood Network. Questions for him, I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us the email address, talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on WPR News. Taking a look at urban wood on the program today, and somebody who knows probably more than anybody else anywhere is Duane Sperber. He is the owner of Woodward and founding member and advisor of the Urban Wood Network. If questions for him, I hope you'll join in or maybe have an experience working within that network. Love to hear from you. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us the email address talk@wpr.org. How many members does the organization have here in Wisconsin? Do you know offhand?
Between 30 and 40. We used to be, it fluctuates over time. And our association just had a tremendous advancement in transition. And so we're going to be building those numbers up very quickly, beginning now. And again, anyone can be a member, from student to arborist to architect to maker to sawyer, someone who, owns a sawmill or in a kiln. And so everyone is welcome.
Peter in De Pere has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Peter.
Well, not so much a question as a concern. We find that we do this, urban wood, cut slab, and we find that the wires and the nails and the hooks and all that really cause a problem. And you can't just use a regular sawmill. You have to use a bandsaw, because when you hit one, it's only $30 versus maybe $1,000. Do you want to comment?
Yeah, I do. We have a pretty sophisticated metal detection system that is, I'll say, mostly accurate. And we do, like I said, we do operate a circle mill. And as you know, you sound seasoned, that if we don't find it, the sawmill blade will. And I'll answer this by saying it this way. It's a reality that we accept, and we're just very careful in doing, but we will hit metal every once in a while. And we also have a band sawmill, a wood miser, for our slab work as well. But I'll tell you what, that circle mill is so efficient that we're going to do our darndest to find any metal in there and keep making lumber.
So what kind of a device? It's not a magnet.
It's actually a common, very familiar-looking metal detector.
Oh!
Yeah, it's a metal detector. Yeah, by hand. It's not any type of robotic machine that the log goes through like some of the big mills use.
Yeah.
But we're also pretty, at the risk of sounding arrogant, we're pretty experienced. There's telltale signs. And there's all kinds of methods that, and I'll have to say, I'm not saying that it isn't a concern for a lot of folks. We've just accepted it and adjusted to that. But you're exactly right. That is a consideration for those to make.
Peter, thank you so much. Good question. Let's go to Daniel in Fitchburg. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, how are you?
Great. Appreciate the call, Daniel.
Yeah, I'm calling because just yesterday my neighbors had two healthy locust trees cut down from their backyard and front yard, and now all of the wood's just stacked out on the road. And I'm just wondering if, like, it could still at this point be repurposed by one of these urban wood organizations, or if it's something that, like, has to be initiated before, like, the whole tree is cut down.
That's a very good question. It is a you must break that topic early on in the process. That wood might already have a destination set up by the homeowner and or the remover. However, in this scenario, that urbanwoodnetwork.org website can, I'm not suggesting that you do that, but there are a lot of folks on there who could and would be interested in those logs. We see that scenario all the time. We'll always see, boy, there's a load of logs. I wonder where they're going. And many times, I'm sorry to say, we're too late when you see them out by the street. But wouldn't it be wonderful one day that every tree care company considered that highest use for that log and made arrangements, ahead of time, or offered that option to the homeowner? And that's what we're working on right now. I've been doing this for over 20 years, and the industry remains very new. It's new every day to a lot of folks, and that's why it's good talking about it here.
Yeah, and tree care companies, I imagine you're doing a fair amount of education, or I've tried to do a fair amount of education with tree care companies.
Absolutely, and part of my role with the sawmill is I specifically target, but I reach out to municipalities. And many times they're understaffed, under-budgeted, it's a liability. But really, everyone is supportive of urban wood. I mean, who wouldn't be?
Yeah.
Let's use a tree. But it has to make sense. And so I'm introducing a service that can help, you know, change and help save them resources, human resources, wear and tear on bodies, and actually the full definition of a resource. Let's utilize this wood. It has wonderful community value because that wood returns back to that community in the form of jobs, functional products, that social equity. There's a lot of research that says we like being around wood. Yeah. We like seeing wood. And it helps us. So getting close to nature too. I know I sound like an old hippie, but but that stuff, that all of that good research is true.
Danielle, thank you very much for calling. Let's go to Tom in Madison. Tom, what's on your mind?
Well, I might just caught a little bit of your show, and it may have been already covered. But I have a scenario where I have had three large black walnuts grow up, and that they were topped, and now they're just sitting out here in the back, and don't know what I can do with them. I know I've gotten urban wood, I believe, from Habitat, made window trim, and put shelves up. So I'm wondering if this is a situation where this wood could be used for a good purpose.
Absolutely, and I know who supplies that. The Restore. Is that what you said, the Restore Habitat store?
Yes, sir.
And I don't know, it's probably not appropriate to share his name, but on the website you will find quite a few folks here in the Madison area. I would check, you know, for example, in the city of Oregon, there's a good company there that that I think that this is a beautiful scenario. This website can do you a lot of good. And I love getting this question. 20 years ago, we weren't getting these questions, and we didn't have an answer for you. So I would certainly check out urbanwoodnetwork.org, look for Wisconsin makers, and walnut is a desirable wood, and they can take it from there. There's a lot of different scenarios. There's a lot of different, sometimes money changes hands, sometimes it doesn't. So, you know, be prepared to, both of you will learn, you know. About how this goes.
Yeah, and black walnut.
The desirable wood.
Yeah, very desirable wood. Tom, good luck with that. Get online and check it out and make that call. I'm sure you're going to find somebody who's very happy to talk with you about the black walnut trees, for sure. You can trade in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to talk@wpr.org. What happens to the wood that isn't good enough for projects like yours?
Let's put it in context, like what we receive.
Yeah.
Well, we also, because we accept everything, a lot of that wood is worthy of firewood only. For example, the sawmill is heated with wood, with the boiler system.
Oh.
A lot of it will go to pallet wood or some type of industrial sacrificial use. And something that's very exciting, the U.S. Forest Service helped the mill develop and get the right equipment and process to develop animal bedding. We're in a very agricultural area, and so... like as I said, every little bit of that tree is utilized, and the animal bedding feeds mainly the dairy industry.
Yeah,
they get it by the semi load, and that is a very key step to urban wood utilization. I am just as excited about seeing that pile of mulch that's been further processed into fine powder suitable for animal bedding, because that helps. That helps that municipality get that wood to us so that we can consider the best and highest use for that wood. And that keeps it out of the landfill. And I'm going to say in some scenarios, it's okay. Meaning I'm not critical of a municipality who has to chip their wood. We get it. But when it is convenient, feasible, when they've really studied the numbers, let's get that wood to a sawmill or someone who will really keep those trees alive through products.
You've got an event coming up in October. I want to be sure to mention that. Tell us about it.
Yeah, thank you. Now, you heard me say earlier that this urban wood, even after all these years, is still a new product to most. And, you know, a key person to get this wood out into the built environment are architects, interior designers, and those who collaborate in the built environment, those who influence materials. And so 5 years ago, my company initiated a annual tree planting event, and I'm partnering this year, well, for several years now, with AIA Wisconsin, again, American Institute of Architects here in Wisconsin. And we have organized our fifth annual tree planting event, which is called Trees First, Wood Next, Connecting Living and Built Environments. And this year we will be planting trees at the new SSM Health Clinic in Sun Prairie, Wisconsin. And these events were really inspired to bring together, again, architects and others who shape the built environment, really to help them identify that their role in not only the living forest, urban and community forest, but also the products that can come from that forest. I'd like to include that Findorff Construction is a sponsor of this event, and they were the general contractor for the new clinic. The architect, Kaylor Slater, here in Madison, was the architect on the project, and they're going to be on hand along with Sun Prairie's urban forester and their sustainability leader there. SSM Health will have a presence at this event. And we'll be providing presentations and so on. So, again, our industry doesn't exist without the planting and care of trees. And so it's my way of, I was just inspired. Let's get that architect's hands dirty. Let's let them realize that they have a role in forestry and in urban forestry. And along the way, they're going to get to learn about what these trees can one day become, you know, wood products.
And people, anybody could show up for that.
I will have to say, Larry, that this is not an open public event. They must register. Again, we're looking for those who collaborate in the built environment, those who make decisions. I'm sorry it's not a public event this year. So it's targeting. So if you're an architect, an interior designer, a developer, a wood-using industry, come to the event, and you can register at AIAW.org and search their events for October. And the cool part about this is that AIA Wisconsin puts on an Arctoberfest, A-R-C-H-toberfest. So the whole month of October, AIA Wisconsin offers all kinds of either tours or activities. And so I feel so very fortunate that they included this tree planting event in their Arctoberfest. So October 4th, Saturday, 9 to 12, we want to get people out quickly so they can enjoy the rest of their Saturday, plant trees, learn about urban wood, and see a pretty innovative, sustainably built clinic by SSM Health.
That is very, very cool.
Yeah.
Well, Tessin Stoughton has a question for you. Let's go there. Tess, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hey, so I am working with a local nonprofit, and one thing that we are trying to do is restore the native oak savanna on the property we live on. And part of that is removing a bunch of invasive buckthorn trees. So I'm wondering, is there any interest in taking those buckthorn trees, or is there anyone who can maybe come help us cut them down? Because right now it's just me and a chainsaw.
Oh, my. You've got your work cut out for you. Take a good pair of gloves. I know the DNR had an active, somebody's always doing a buckthorn removal. I don't really know what to tell you, but I was excited about, I have to say, a decade ago, there was a company in Chicago who would take all the buckthorn you could provide them, and they were making some unique furniture out of it.
Oh.
And they got overrun with buckthorn. I would like to suggest to you to reach out to your DNR. Either urban forestry or forest products. And I believe they can, and I'll tell you what, if you want to find me online, email me and I'll direct you to a good person who could provide you some direction.
Woodward is the name of your site.
Mm-hmm. Woodward.com.
Woodward.com, and Woodward is spelled W-U-D-E-W-A-R-D.
I'd be so happy to assist you if I can.
Duane, thank you very much for being with us today. It's a pleasure. The time flew, and I'm sure we'll be getting you back and do this again.
I sure hope so, Larry. It's always, you're such a nice guy.
Thank you. You are too. Dwayne Sperber, our guest, owner of Woodward and founding member and advisor of the Urban Wood Network. It's really interesting to hear what he's done and continues to do. And thank you for joining us today. This and all our shows are a team effort. Our producers, Claire Nyper, Joel Patnut, our technical directors, Jeff Robbins and Lee Rayburn. Our executive producer is Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. Enjoy your day and stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.